There's a wealth of good writing in prose and in poetry about the natural world around us. But the examples that come to mind first for many people may be writing by men. Darn that Henry David Thoreau. We'll give Thoreau and the men a drive-by in this hour because there's a lot of great writing about nature, past and present, by women. Catherine Aalto quotes some of it and writes about a lot of it in Writing Wild, Women Poets, Ramblers, and Mavericks Who Shape How We See the Natural World. Catherine Aalto is a landscape designer, historian, and writer, an American living in Exeter in Devon, southwest England. While in the Northwest, Catherine renovated an old farm and taught school. Her previous books include The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh. Catherine, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a delight to be here. And I'm a Californian, so hearing about the forecast, I am looking at my gray windows here in England makes me quite wistful.
Bit of a difference for sure, yeah. The difference in the way we enjoy nature, though, that you really opened my eyes when you mentioned the UK's right to roam laws. Tell us about those.
Well, I moved to England about 13 years ago, and the second day moving here, I stumbled upon a book on walking public footpaths, and the right to, and so they are everywhere. I just quickly discovered that we do have a right to roam here. There's an ancient network of public footpaths. So I, as you mentioned, lived in southwest England, and if I wanted to, I could walk right out my back door and follow a series of public footpaths all the way up to the Hebrides in Scotland if I wanted. And these were created by, over the centuries and probably thousands of years, from people walking from a hamlet to a cemetery or a market town to the next town to another hamlet, and drovers moving their animals from one part, you know, maybe from the south of England to eat acorns in a different part of England. So the native, the landscape is man-made, all these footpaths everywhere. And in the U.S., we just don't have them. I mean, perhaps we had them with indigenous peoples and as they moved around, but our, you know, Western movement maybe obliterated them. We just don't have the same thing. So here they're preserved and you can walk all over, and it's absolutely a dream landscape.
Wow, so that's wonderful that you get to write about walking about various parts of the UK in addition to what you write about the other writers here in the book. Now, lots obviously said about men writing about the wild. What sent you down this trail?
Well, that's a good question. As I mentioned, I grew up in California. I grew up in the Central Valley in a small farming town called Escalon. I was curious what came before this huge, cultivated, big ag landscape. So I remember reading an essay that John Muir wrote about walking from San Francisco to Yosemite. And I loved the first-person narrative. I liked that he was on foot. I liked seeing natural history from that personal viewpoint. So at university, I ended up, I'm a huge fan of Henry David Thoreau. I love his work, but, you know, you hear about Thoreau and Emerson and Whitman and Hawthorne. You don't hear about, you know, the Margaret Fullers, and of course we know about Emily Dickinson. And the question is, well, why is that? Like, I taught American literature of nature and place, and I write about the natural world. That's kind of my beat. So one thing led to another, and in a couple years ago, I read an article in Outside Magazine, the American outdoor magazine, and the article was published in 2003. It was on social media, and it was called 25 Books All Well-Read Travelers Should Read, and I read through the list, and I realized 22 out of the 25 books were by white guys. And I don't like to, you know, poo-poo what has come before. I'm simply saying in my book that, you know, there are other voices, not just women, and diverse voices too. It's not just the realm of white folk, the enraptured people walking out into romantic pastoral landscapes. So, Writing Wild the book came from a response that I wrote to that article. It was my response was a feature in Outside Magazine, and then I was asked to write a book, and so this book is expanded from that article.
And if people are thinking, well, come on, I mean, how different can nature be from person to person? You give a really good example, which is how we see a tree, and how different can that be from one person to another?
That's exactly right. So, you know, I can even read that if you'd like.
Sure,
that section. So I'll just read a paragraph here. Gender, race, and physical abilities are also important prisms through which to understand how people access and experience the natural world. If you are white, for example, a poplar tree may look innocuous, an innocent object of beauty. Imagine, though, that you are unable to reach it over a rocky trail. If you are disabled and cannot access its shade or touch its leaves, how might your relationship to the tree change? If you are black, that same tree may have a more sinister feel, perhaps a symbol of lynching's legacy. Think of jazz star Billie Holiday's haunting rendition of the song Strange Fruit. Within a musical landscape of minor chords, Holiday transports us to the gallant South and a lynching scene where bodies swing like fruit from trees, leaves and roots soaked in blood.
You said gallant that way. I'm sorry, I need to interrupt you, but you said gallant that way because it is in quotes, I'm guessing.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Within a musical landscape of minor chords, Holiday transports us to the gallant South and a lynching scene where bodies swing like fruit from trees, leaves and roots soaked in blood. It's a vivid example of how perspective colors experience. If we don't give diverse narratives, first, the opportunity to exist, and second, recognition and legitimacy, it can appear that able-bodied white guys have, in the words of comedian Hannah Gadsby, a monopoly on the human experience.
Catherine, I'm thinking once you start making this bookshelf, it's an endless one. I mean, how did you manage to limit the list to 25? And 25 majors, I should point out, plus the others.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Thank you. As I was writing it, I began to think of this genre as I felt like a jeweler. You know, I began to feel like I was taking this diamond and carving it out. And what I was trying to do was create as many facets to this gem as possible. So women who are opening the gates to a new field, you know, in nature writing. So I reached as far back as Dorothy Wordsworth, who's the sister of her more famous brother, William Wordsworth. She did all sorts of amazing things. We could talk about her maybe. Through 200 years of women, of writing by women. So I was trying to create something as multifaceted as possible. And you're right, there are 25 main essays, really diverse essays, where I'm exploring the lives, literature, landscapes, and legacies of remarkable women.
I'm thinking in some ways this is a harder assignment than some others for a writer because you've got to know, and your editor does too, obviously, when to let their work come through and then when to write about them.
Well, yes, and each essay needed to be well balanced too. So I kind of hit my stride when I wrote about Vita Sackville-West. Mm-hmm. She was a poet and a famous garden maker. Some of your listeners probably have been to Sissinghurst. Sissinghurst Castle Garden is one of the most famous gardens in the world, and there's a whole backstory to it. And so when I got to that essay, I had been to Sissinghurst, and it was well balanced between me you hear my voice. I do let the women shine, but I'm kind of like a field guide, and I'm pointing up to the constellation of these women and saying, look to them. But I'm definitely in every essay. So every essay needed to have the same weight. There's lots of permissions in this book, so we had to work with lots of publishers to find, you know, kind of the essence of each writer and get permission to show, you know, have extensive excerpts. So it was me balancing everything out and trying to make sure I went back far enough so people could appreciate where we've been, and then the diverse voices as well. So that's why all the what we call, my editor and I call them, our side paths. At the end of most essays, I offer reading in the general area, you know, additional reading, so side paths that people could take to explore a particular topic even further.
For example, Cheryl Strayed doesn't get a full chapter, but she does end up at the end of one of the chapters as, you know, you might consider reading about, if you like this subject matter, here's another person to read. Cheryl Strayed, of course, wrote, what was her book?
Wild.
Okay. Yes. Yes. About walking the Pacific Crest Trail after a particularly horrible period in her life. I'm glad you brought up Vita Sackville West because she's got a great opening quote. I worshipped dead men for their strength, forgetting I was strong. Wow. Where did that come from?
That came from one of her poems. It was just a couple lines. I was reading one and I thought, oh my goodness, that's one that we need to put at the beginning of her chapter. You know, and there's lots of, places in the writing where women, you know, they do mention, you know, how they feel in the world, but a lot of things are behind the scenes. You know, you have each woman, experience some sort of bullying or bias or something they had to, many of the women had to overcome things that we today don't really think about. And for me, every woman in the book feels living and breathing. And I'm glad the artist for the book created this scene of a meadow with women in a meadow together, because I feel like I know them. You know, for example, Dorothy Wordsworth lived 200 years ago, and she was the inspiration for her brother, and she inspired these other famous lake poets, but she was a letter writer and a travel writer and a poet in her own right. She just left her notebook open, and her brother, William Wordsworth, nicked a few lines for his famous poem on daffodils. And, you know, women in those days also, we didn't have access to university, so Dorothy did not go to university. And we also had, if we wanted to take a walk, we had to be chaperoned by men, husbands, sons, uncles, whoever. Otherwise, we could suffer from what was called reputational anxiety. And so Dorothy Wordsworth got a series of reprimanding letters from an aunt saying, you know, why do you insist on taking walks under the midnight walks under the moonlight? You know, you're going to get in trouble, so... And we also, you know, Susan Fenimore Cooper, who I write about next, she was known as the daughter of her more famous father, James Fenimore Cooper, who wrote The Last of the Mohicans. He's considered the America's first novelist. Well, she wrote Rural Hours, a diary of living in Cooperstown, New York, in 1850. Well, who gets most of the credit is Henry David Thoreau. He wrote Walden, but he wrote it 4 years, it was published 4 years after Rural Hours. So we can argue that Susan Fenimore Cooper was America's first nature writer, but is she a household name? I don't think so. So she had her own issues that she had to deal with too as a writer. So I counted on one page of Walden. I'm a huge fan of Thoreau, so I'm not putting him down, but he had the privilege of using the word I on one page. It was like 17 times I counted. Well, for women, it was considered inappropriate. Like, we couldn't use that first person pronoun. We also couldn't use our first name, our names. So by a lady and anonymous, they were always women. And then, you know, publishing has always been male dominated and white male dominated too, maybe perhaps a little bit less so now. But imagine not being able to use I, not being able to take a walk, not alone, not being able to use your name, and having it difficult being published. Well, there's a reason why. And, you know, the finances also, I mean, you could think about Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. We need, you know, money and time alone to write. So by looking farther back and then bringing things forward, I hope readers can appreciate where we've been.
Well, as Susan Fenimore Cooper, you know, despite the fact that the way women were perceived was very much twisted by the culture of her time, I mean, the fact is that she had a very clear look at trees, for example. The trees have other values, she wrote. Expand on what that meant, and it's important still.
Yeah, well, she believed that she was looking at her on her walk. She would look at people taking down trees, and these are I don't want to say pioneers, you know, settlers moving into areas where Native Americans still were. And she talks about the importance of Phyllis. She was one of the first people of thinking globally and acting locally, this philosophy. And she does talk about the value of trees, you know, independent of market prices in dollars and cents, and the importance of leaving trees, that they could be more beautiful than, you know, furniture made out of trees. And so she was really important, maybe a precursor to Aldo Leopold and other people writing about, you know, a land ethic. And so also, and it's a brilliant portrait into life of these, you know, early folks in this area of Cooperstown, New York, too, and how people looked forward to the robins returning every year and some of the foibles of an Irish farmer coming in and thinking he could tap into maples all year round and the locals wondering when he was going to get the hint that it's only a certain time of the year. So it's beautiful writing and really insightful, too. One of the early land ethic writers.
Catherine Alto is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, calling in from Devon in southwest England. She lives in Exeter. She is from California originally and spent some time in the Northwest as well. She has written a book about women writers called Writing Wild, Women Poets, Ramblers, and Mavericks Who Shape How We See the Natural World. You're invited to take part in the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's move on to another author and discuss the Limberlost. I had heard of this. I'd heard of Girl of the Limberlost. What was the Limberlost and who made it famous?
Oh, that's, oh, well, you're talking, every woman in this book is one of my favorites, but I love Jean Stratton Porter. So Jean, many readers thought this was a man writing, but her husband gave her the nickname Jean from Geneva. And if people are interested in she is in Writing Wild, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but I write for Smithsonian Magazine as well, and I was given the opportunity to write 5,000 words about her for the March issue. So you can go back, look on the internet, and see a twice as long biography or profile of her. So Jean Stratton Porter is interesting because she straddles this time period when there were lots of gender changes for women. And so she was born in 1863 and died in 1924. She was a girl who loved birds. She lived on a farm in Indiana, and she was given stewardship of all the birds on her father's farm after he shot a red-tailed hawk and she protested and brought it back, nursed it back to health. Her father was a minister and said, please, you know, take care of all the birds. So she, from an early age, at one point she was looking after 65 nests of just a great variety of birds. And she learned to be quiet. She learned how to feed young to gain the trust of mother birds. And she took this interest into her adult life. And she ended up marrying someone named Charles Porter. And she moved to a place near a place called the Limberlost. She moved to actually a town called Geneva, Indiana. And the Limberlost was 13,000 acres of hardwood forests, swamps, and wetlands. And it was all being taken down, the trees for furniture and everything. There was a Swamp Act in 1850, so if you drained a swamp, the land was yours. And so it's kind of like the history of the Midwest, all this area. So she watched it disappear, and eventually it was planted with corn and soybeans, which you can see there in the area now. But she was a birder there, and she loved moths as well. So Jean Stratton Porter is fascinating. She was the J.K. Rowling of a century ago. She wrote 28 books, sort of sappy romantic nature novels that were made into films, and brilliant books about the natural world. And they're so wonderful. My favorite books about that she's written are about moths and birds I've known. And she's in the narrative as this intrepid, shotgun-holding, trouser-wearing, free spirit who was also one of the first photographers, was the first photographer, male or female, to capture birds in their natural habitat in photography. The men before would shoot them, stuff them, and pose them. So she was world famous. She sold more than 50 million books in her lifetime. And you can go to the Limberlost now, and there's an area that's been hundreds of acres have been restored to the way that Gene Stratton Porter wrote about them. So it's a case of life imitating art, imitating life, and it's a place called the Limberlost Historical Site. You can see it now, but. And she was also responsible for heightening public awareness of where feathers and hats came from. And women wore incredibly extravagant hats, often with several stuffed birds in them, and the entire bird. So she helped raise consciousness of that fashion foible. So she's hugely influential. And there needs to be a Gene Stratton Porter Renaissance.
Now, the next author you introduce through your childhood, observing places named for guys and some exceptions, Mary Hunter Austin is who we're talking about here.
Yeah, so Mary Austin is really interesting. Yeah, so I grew up in my town in California. It's quite a feminine landscape, I thought, growing up. Every street, it seems, is named after a woman or a girl or a fruit or a nut. So I grew up on Lemon Avenue, and, you know, there was Jill Court and Zinfandel Drive and this sort of thing. So I always felt everything was quite feminine, but, you know, I'd look up and see the long spine of the Sierra and eventually explored there while hiking and so forth. And, you know, most of the peaks there are named after soldiers and surveyors and geologists and maybe a president or two, scientists, but there's one peak, and it's named for Mount Mary Austin. And so Mary Austin is also an incredibly engaging person who wrote The Land of Little Rain in 1903. And she celebrated in vivid writing the flora, fauna, indigenous people, miners of the Owens River Valley in the Southern Sierras. So if you know the movie Chinatown, which is one of my favorite movies, it is the Land of Little Rain is the story of that Owens River Valley before L.A. grabbed all the water. And so she captures like a picture, a time before it's all drained, just like Gene Stratton Porter did in The Limberlost. I'm glad you brought up these two women. So she became a leading voice for indigenous people, and she was an early feminist writer, a suffragette, and wrote some utopian science fiction. So Mary Austin had a very, very hard life. She was married to a bit of a spendthrift, and she ended up spending, you know, a long time getting them out of debt after her husband's financial misinvestments. You know, she had a daughter with, I believe, Down syndrome, and her family blamed her for her daughter. She ended up institutionalizing, you know, their daughter and divorcing her husband and having this incredibly rich life of travel and speaking and writing. And she just knew everybody. She knew Ansel Adams and Isadora Duncan and Emma Goldman and Georgia O'Keeffe. Like, she was one of the who's who of modernism. And
there was a picture I chose not to use because it was mostly men, but it was her sitting on a beach with the likes of Jack London.
That's right. I have seen that picture too, down in Carmel. Is that right?
Right.
I've seen that too. And you look at it and you think, goodness, she really did do that, you know. she is an absolute maverick, really hard life, but absolutely dedicated to her writing. And she just did so many things. She had plays and novels and you know, all sorts of she made a really big impact on the field. So, and she has a mountain named after her.
Yes, that is a big one. Now, did she actually watch LA steal the Owens Valley water? Was she there when that happened?
I think by 1913 it was complete. That is my sense of it. Mm-hmm. So she captured it. I think she knew what was going on. It didn't happen immediately, but you know, it does capture it. But she knew that it was beginning to happen because there's a quote in the book. I probably won't have time to get right to it, but you know, that every ditch is, every little creek is on its way to becoming a ditch.
Nan Shepherd is the next one I want to talk about. She takes us from the sedate English countryside to a somewhat wilder place. Where?
Well, Nan Shepherd is a really interesting person who wrote a book called The Living Mountain. So she was Scottish, the kind of book she wrote was kind of like a, let me go back and tell you about the history of it. So she wrote a couple of novels that were well-known during the Scottish modernist movement in the 1920s. The landscape, the Cairngorms in south near Aberdeen in southeast Scotland, it was kind of an area emptied of men after World War One and then World War Two. So she wrote the book a little bit after World War Two. It's about 30,000 words, so it's a very slim volume. But then she took the manuscript and she put it in a drawer. And did it sit there for a week or two or three? No, it sat in a dark drawer in her home in Aberdeen, Scotland for almost 40 years. So why did she keep this beautiful manuscript in there? Well, it's quite a sensuous book, and I don't mean sexual, I mean sensual. Stravaging. Stravaging is a Scottish word for wandering alone or with friends in all seasons and weather. And so it's a book about, it's part, it's reverential prose poetry, it's part memoir, part natural history, and part philosophical meditation. And it's just this beautiful, shimmering journey of her, walking into a mountain, for example, rather than up. And I say up because a lot of the mountaineering literature of the time, was by mountaineers and scientists, men. And so my thinking, and I do tell the reader this after going through the essay, I think she left the manuscript in the drawer for almost 40 years because she was fearful of what the male-dominated mountaineering community would think. And in fact, this was borne out when in, there was this... what is his name? There is a scientist who, Adam Watson, who in as late as 2016, he lampooned her book as sort of fanciful and contrived and anthropomorphic. And that was what she was fearful about. So he made some, he's no longer around. And in fact, I've been told by friends that he would rather admire my take on things. He just it was quite no nonsense. I feel like the book is so well received right now and so important. In fact, she's so important that she now appears with the Cairngorms behind her on the Scottish 5-pound note. So she's had such an impact on Scottish identity and so forth. And this book is so important. It's sort of this Buddhist inspired pilgrimage into the Cairngorms, and it really conveys a sense of place and what it can feel like to be in a landscape rather than trying to climb up it and sort of, you know, climaxing a landscape. She sort of enjoys the recesses and waking up in a landscape. So The Living Mountain is definitely a beautiful book that I highly recommend everybody pick up.
I was really impressed that the Royal Bank of Scotland found it worthy to put her on the 5-pound note. That is impressive. Now, there's no way this collection could leave out Rachel Carson, and it does not. So there she is. But there are what do you see in Carson's ability to convey complicated scientific information?
Well, this is one of the reasons why you can change environmental policy. So Silent Spring was published in 1962, I believe. Sorry, I'm getting some of my dates mixed up here. It was the first book that conveyed complex scientific theories and knowledge into easily understood language. So Rachel Carson was a biologist, and a friend was having songbirds turn up in her garden dead. And so with a team of female-led scientists, Rachel Carson did a lot of research and made connections between DDT that killed mosquitoes and sort of this web of life. So she was one of the very first people to write a book so popular that today people look back and, well, it's deemed one of the 25 most influential books about science. And it's influential because she doesn't talk over people. She distills complex knowledge. And, you know, she actually experienced a lot of bullying from the chemical industry. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but one scientist once said, well, how can you trust a spinster with no children, with questions related to biology?
Yeah.
And so she was kind of like, I liken her in the book to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, she was quiet and forceful and knew her science and through storytelling was able to help establish. Well, she died in 1964, but that book helped establish the EPA.
Right, yeah, because there was an EPA just, what, 8 years after the publication of the book.
That's exactly right, yeah.
I want to ask about Camille T. Dungy. She's later in the book, but I mean, it's just excellent that somebody actually wrote a poem called Trophic Cascade. We've talked about trophic cascades specifically in Yellowstone, which is what she writes about in poetry.
Yes, and she does what very few female nature writers do, which she talks, she's a mother, and not more than half of the women here are not mothers, and many of them were not married, and that might be kind of the leveler for them to get out and explore, to be free of husbands and children. But Camille is brilliant. Camille T. Dungy is a living poet now, rather young, I would say, and Trophic Cascade is about, trophic cascade is the introduction of one species into an environment that fundamentally sort of changes everything. And she writes about, we think that the poem called Language by Camille Dungy is about, you know, the wolves being reintroduced to Yellowstone. And it turns out that actually that is really about, it's not called Language, it's called Trophic Cascade, my apology. And really, it's a poem at the very last lines are about how she likens her new child to being kind of a wolf that changes her own landscape inside. And the last few lines are, all this life born from one hungry animal, this whole new landscape, the course of the river changed. I know this. I reintroduced myself to myself, this time a mother, after which nothing was ever the same. And you read that poem as a mother, and you just think, zing, you had no idea what was coming at you. And she's really interesting. I had a wonderful interview with her, and she talks about what it means to be a black woman writing about motherhood. And it's a really compelling, she said it's really problematic for her to write from a motherhood perspective because she's saying to the world, hey, I'm a mammal. And that can be, it's transgressive, she said, you know, the way people have been made into animals, you know, against their will, i.e. enslaved people. And yet she says she has all these things in common with the greater than human world that she wanted to write about this vital connection as a mother. So she's wonderful, really, really interesting writer.
It was really a revelation to read her stuff. Let's talk to Mark and Merlin. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Catherine Alto, the author of Writing Wild.
Oh, good morning. I was wondering if your book covered anything about Louisa May Alcott. She's one of my favorites from the late 1800s, there's a farmstead that you get to go visit. It's a museum in Farmington, Connecticut. And she was a crony of William James. Ralph Waldo Emerson, I think, was pretty much, he was pretty old at the time. But anyway, a lot of them got together at that, the Transcendentalists from New England got together at that farmstead in what's now Farmington. And she's kind of inspiring if you read her essays, more than just her novels and books. And she was considered one of the boys, so to speak. She was allowed in that circle of intelligentsia.
Okay, thanks for that, Mark.
Yeah, Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I she was one of the women that I was, you know, debating, like, where can I put her in? But I do include other women, I'm looking them up right now. But I wasn't able to include her. I am reading about the Peabody sisters right now, who helped create, you know, the American Renaissance. And one of those sisters was related, married to Hawthorne. So I'm keen on that time period, very much so, but I wasn't able to bring her in. But thank you for mentioning that to the listeners.
I wanted to ask about Mary Oliver. You say you can recite her poem Wild Geese by heart. What's it about?
Well, Wild Geese is a book about, well, Mary Oliver is considered one of, she was America's most beloved poet and until she died recently. And Wild Geese is really about forgiving people for maybe expecting more of them and accepting who you are. Would you like me to read it to you? I'm guessing that might be a prompt.
We have about a minute for it because we're getting close on time.
Well, people can look it up, but okay. It really is about how we are not greater than the natural world. We're part of it, and we're all in this family of things. It's a beautiful poem to read, and people often burst into tears. I've read it a few times in public for various things, and it's very hard to listen to, but it's beautiful.
Mary Oliver, I understand, is the best-selling poet in the United States?
Well, she's regarded, she might be one of the best-selling, mm-hmm. but she's, I think that might be it. Yeah, I it's been a while since I've, I know she's one of the most best-selling, yeah.
Okay, let's see, we've got about 2 minutes left, so we got to be efficient here. Saatchi Lloyd, she writes cli-fi. This is an interesting category I hadn't heard about until you mentioned it in the book. What is it?
Cli-fi is a word that stands for climate change fiction, and so Saatchi Lloyd is a British young adult writer, and she writes not dystopian fiction for children. She writes what's considered opportunities to envision a different world, and so she is author of The Carbon Diaries, amongst other things, and so we took a walk in Epping Forest together, and she conveyed the idea that, her plan for the world is to continue writing this way. And I do have a note she wrote to me. She said, my plan for the rest of my life is to set myself on fire with enthusiasm so people will come for miles to watch me burn. I will roar for nature. So Saatchi is the most hilarious. She brings a lot of humor into her writing, too. A lot of nature writers tend to be, you know, serious. You know, you can't joke at a funeral. If the world is burning around you, you can't be cracking jokes. But I think humor is a way of reaching people, and she's trying to do that with young people through her writing.
We mentioned at the outset that this project has a lot to do with the response to Outside Magazine writing about some of the greatest writers about the outdoors, and 22 of the 25 were white guys, and this is something of a response to this. Are the requirements for women writers, Catherine, different for those from men? I mean, are there different standards?
Oh, I don't think so. That's a good question. I don't think there are any different standards. Do you?
Well, no, I'm just asking if there's still some level of discrimination there. It's like, well, you know, they could write that, but it's still like, you know, women writing about the environment or some garbage like that.
Yeah, well, I don't know if there's still sexism in this particular field. I know that there's lots of women writing about the natural world. I don't think it's necessarily because, you know, women write differently about the natural world. I mean, what we might do is write more about interconnections between things, and we might listen to other voices. And this is where, you know, I end the book with Elizabeth Rush talking about her book, about her book called Rising. It's about rising sea levels. And, she's striding on American shores, listening to other people tell their stories. It's possible that we're better listeners and make better connections between things, but that's a generalization.
It's a fascinating book. It is called Writing Wild, Women Poets, Ramblers, and Mavericks Who Shape How We See the Natural World. It's 25 great writers and a bunch more as well, assembled by Catherine Alto. Catherine, thank you for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you for having me. It was a delight.
Take care.